Hello, my name is Craig Faust with Life Care Counseling, and you are listening to St. Louis Therapist Spotlight. And I am just going to meet with another fellow therapist that I know does good work and talk with them a little bit about their practice and their specialties. So if it's something that you feel like may be a good fit for you or someone that you know, then you may be able to get in contact with them. So without any further delay, here we go. Hello, this is Craig from Life Care Counseling, and I'm here with Erin. Erin, can you say hi to everyone?
Hi, I'm Erin Grumley. My practice is embodied self-counseling.
So I just want to say, like, right now I am sitting in Erin's office, and one of the first things that I noticed when I was coming to your office was the aroma. Like, you have candles lit. The lighting is, it's very non-assaulting or anything like that. I'm kind of, was that purposeful?
Very intentional. I don't particularly love overhead lighting at all. Mm-hmm. It's hard on your eyes. It just doesn't feel, it's exhausting if you sit in it all day, but it doesn't help anybody. I really like the soft lighting. The candle I have burning is one, there's a place in the Central West End where you can develop your own scent. Mm-hmm. And make your own candles. So that is what is burning right now, is my personal scent from there.
I think it's pleasant. It adds a nice touch to it.
Thank you.
Just to even kind of give people an idea of what I'm seeing, like, this is comfortable space. I feel like it is, even just like as far as the lighting goes, like, I feel like I walk in here and I can feel myself relax. Even sitting in this chair. So this is a great job.
Thank you.
Designing this. So, Erin, I was hoping that you can tell me a little bit about your practice and the people that you serve.
Okay. So I am actually really new to St. Louis. I went to Northwestern. I lived in California after that. And so I did mm-hmm. most of my internship hours out in California. Moved back here because I was bleeding money, because everybody does out there. And I worked in community mental health in, like, way southern Illinois.
I feel like most of us counselors and therapists, we have to start in community mental health. And so for you, now that you've shifted into your own practice, can you tell me a little bit about the people that you serve? Like, if I'm someone that's listening to this and I'm hearing you and I'm like, hey, I like the way that the office sounds, you know, I like the sound of your voice or anything, you're very calming. Mm-hmm. How would I know, or what would I be dealing with that would kind of let me know that you'd be a good fit for me?
So I see a lot of clients who struggle with eating disorders. Mm-hmm. Of all ranges, whether, you know, anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, binge eating, not otherwise specified. And with those come a lot of, like, people tend to be present as perfectionists. So beyond the eating disorder, like, I'm also mm-hmm. used to working with a lot of people who identify maybe as a perfectionist or identify as a highly sensitive person. I think a lot of those kind of end up going hand in hand. I also work with a lot of trans clients. Mm-hmm. With the things that come along with identifying as trans, with your family, with the community, the stresses, anxieties that come along with that.
Like, how to be able to talk about it and how to be able to manage mm-hmm. the different challenges that go along with that.
Absolutely. And I feel very strongly about being comfortable in your skin and comfortable in your body. So hence the kind of the crossover between the two, and that's how I ended up kind of having that crossover, is this idea of not necessarily accepting your body, because, well, and especially with trans clients, it's not accepting your body because it's not the body that necessarily is ideal for you, but it's accepting it because this is what it is today, and I can't hate myself every day in my skin. But so, like, accepting that radical acceptance, and just knowing that, like, today this is who I am and I'm okay in my body. And it can change in the future. And I think that's similarly with eating disorders, is just kind of mm-hmm. learning to be comfortable in the body that we have.
I never really considered those two populations actually having more in common than maybe I would have thought. And it goes right along with the name of your practice too.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to ask you a couple questions. Is that all right?
Absolutely.
So let's start with the eating disorder part. Okay. So can you tell me, like, you told me a lot of different terms there, right? So yes. Like, can you explain them to me, like the anorexia, the bulimia? Like, can you talk to me about those? If I'm someone that's listening to this and maybe I don't know what those mean, could you explain them to me?
Yeah. So somebody with anorexia nervosa, a lot of times we just call it anorexia, is going to be somebody who's restricting their food intake. So, extremely limiting what they're eating. A lot of times that comes along with a lot of food rules and what I'm allowing myself to eat and put into my body. Bulimia is another one that I mentioned, and that one is going to be it's a binge. There's a binge piece to it, and then there is a compensation piece. And I use compensation because that can be that can look different for everybody. For some people, that might be purging, it might be laxatives, exercise, but it is a compensating for the calories or the amount of food that I just took in that binge.
I like that, compensating. So if I'm someone that is maybe binging and purging or compensating, I might have a little bit more of an idea that, like, what I'm going through could be possibly an eating disorder.
Right.
But it sounds like if I'm someone that's suffering from anorexia, especially if I'm restricting, I might not always know. So can you give me some idea if I'm wondering if I'm taking in enough calories or if I'm really restricting and I have some of these rules that are going on, like, you know, if I'm someone that's listening to this, how would I know if this is something that I may be suffering from?
I think that's a really fair question, because I think that really ties into our diet culture that is we're so entrenched in. I hear it all the time. I have family members and friends on keto, and, you know, and that's rules, and that's putting this restriction on what you can put into your body. So I can see this fine line and that unsure moment of, like, has this gone too far? When the obsession with food and what's being put into your body starts interfering with your daily life, when you start avoiding going out to eat with your friends because you don't want to intake, and you don't know what kind of food is going to be there, the anxieties around food and what is coming into your body start taking over and really affecting that day-to-day, your relationships, your concentration. One distraction, but it also, when we're underfed, we aren't processing as fast. So a lot of times that could mean, like, if some people it presents as looking like ADHD, where in reality it's just our brains are underfed and they need that additional nourishment. So as those things kind of start popping up, you notice the thoughts are there, the obsessive thoughts about the food, and I'm struggling to concentrate at work or at school or wherever my daily life takes me, disconnecting from some relationships and friends. That's when things start to become a problem, and it might be time to talk to somebody.
Okay. I feel like you summed that up really well.
Thanks.
Now, you said that a lot of times whenever people present with any type of eating disorder that they also have perfectionistic tendencies. So can you tell me a little bit about that, what that may look like? Like, how would I know if maybe I am more perfectionistic versus I just really like things being done my way?
Well, and what's interesting is I think that perfectionist, we all have this, like, idea of somebody who is the straight A student that gets everything done and everything looks perfect. There's also a presentation of the lazy perfectionist that struggles to get something done because of the fear of it not being perfect. So then avoiding the task, and or if I don't, and subconsciously this idea of not putting the effort in, well, I didn't put the effort in. And so if it's not perfect, that's because, you know, that, so perfectionism can go either way. But I think a lot of times that it is these shoulds and this fear of failure that are in, we should ourselves a lot, if you will. Tell us that internal dialogue that is telling us all the things that we could have done differently, or we could have done better, or I could have said something that was more effective or whatever. Mm-hmm. That internal dialogue is really that piece that we're looking at.
It kind of lets you know the difference between, like, I just really like things done my way.
Right.
Versus I'm having this whole internal dialogue where I'm critiquing everything I do and feeling like I'm not measuring up.
If I don't do it the right way, like, mm-hmm. When that dialogue's going on, I know, like, oh gosh, if I don't do it this way, then I'm going to fail. It's that fear of failure that is really, sticks out for me as a really big, like, red flag.
Okay. Now, you said that you also work with a lot of trans clients. Like, give me an idea. Like, when did you start to notice the commonalities between these two populations? Because they seem like they're really different populations, but the way that you explained it, now I'm kind of like, oh, right, they're actually a lot more similar than I thought.
There's a huge crossover, and I think that that's something that's not really talked about a whole lot in either community, in the eating disorder community or in the trans community. But I think it's growing. I think it is definitely becoming to awareness. But something that I was working in an eating disorder treatment center, outpatient treatment center in California, and I had a client that came through who identified as trans, is trans male, and as we got working together, we had a really successful, really positive relationship. I really noticed a lot of that crossover in, like, the body stuff, and sometimes the gender dysphoria and the body dysmorphia, which are both, I know, very clinical terms that I'm throwing out there, but sometimes the wires get crossed, especially with clinicians, as like, well, which one am I talking to right now?
Well, let's talk about some of those clinical terms.
Yeah.
Can you explain those to me?
So the gender dysphoria, mm-hmm. Is going to be looking more at the not identifying with my biological body. Mm-hmm. So with the gender dysphoria, if I have biologically, I have female parts, but I identify as male, as that is stronger. And on days, that's going to be more distressing for people than on others. So you hear some clients might say, I'm feeling really dysphoric today. And it's really it's becoming something that's really a hang up that day, or it's something that's really bothering them. And so it's that disalignment between the two, between my who I am and what my body is telling me I am.
Yeah. Well, then tell me a little bit about like, where this comes in with eating disorders. You said there's gender dysmorphia. And there's body dysmorphia.
So gender dysphoria.
Dysphoria, I know. Sorry.
And then the body dysmorphia. And the body dysmorphia is just looking into a mirror. And we see, I might see a person who looks like me. But as somebody with gender dysphoria is going to, not just, I'm sorry. Somebody with body dysmorphia is going to look into that mirror and see somebody that the body size is much larger. And so both of those are going to have a voice in that eating disorder. So we talk a lot in eating disorder treatment. We talk a lot about talking to the eating disorder, or ED. And we sometimes, when we are getting into that eating disorder piece, is we have to decide, who is that voice that is controlling ED right now? Is it going to be your body dysmorphia or the gender dysphoria? Because they do both play into it. And I think it's worth figuring out which one is driving it.
Okay. I think that there's actually a lot of interesting research around body dysmorphia, and I'm sure there will with gender dysphoria.
Yes.
Look at that. I'm getting them right now. with a person, they aren't actually usually, they can't actually see reality in those moments. I think that's such a key thing, because for us, if we look in the mirror and we see ourselves, like, we assume that that's what it is. Whenever someone develops some of these disorders, the perception that they are seeing is completely different than what everyone else is, which of course means that they're also feeling something completely different than what everyone else is.
Right.
I know that what that would mean is that if someone's like they're having you know, they see themselves as like, oh, I'm like you said, like I weigh too much, even though they could be severely underweight.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing you can say will convince them otherwise.
Right. Yeah. And everybody around them is saying, you know, you're getting too thin. But when I look in the mirror, that's not what I see. And so therefore I'm continuing those behaviors that are creating that thinness.
It's hard to trust people.
It does.
And then it becomes even harder to trust yourself once you accept that that may be true.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I'm kind of wondering, for you, how do you start to combat that, or how do you start to work with clients around those types of issues that they may be coming to you and seeing?
I think the big thing for me is people, especially with an eating disorder, are often told just, or people question, like, why aren't you just eating? Or you look fine, or whatever it is. They feel like it's easy to identify the, you know, how somebody looks. It's easy to see somebody's behaviors, but, and so we can address those. And I think it's important to address those, but they're so driven by something else. Like, they are coping skills. And there, we have used those, our eating disorder as a coping skill for larger emotions, negative emotions most of the time, and to either numb them or to avoid them. Get into all of the brain stuff in that, but I won't. But it is, I think it's worth looking at the idea of, we have to get deeper if we're going to even touch the eating disorder. If we just play with the behaviors, at the end of the day, we're not healing anything. We need to heal, like, whatever those emotions are, that whether it's trauma, whether it is maybe it's, you know, childhood emotional abuse, whatever it was.
I think what you're saying has a lot of merit. So I don't come from a background working with eating disorders, although I have had substantial experience with that. I actually come from a background working with substance abuse in adolescence.
It's really similar sometimes.
Yeah. So what will happen sometimes is, as you take away the substance use, then all of a sudden an eating disorder pops up, or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
That they're not using any type of drugs, then you start to address the eating disorder piece, like you said, without going to some of the roots and some of the depths where it actually lies. And then all of a sudden, hey, you know what? They may be eating fine now, but then the substance abuse part pops up. And then as soon as you start to deal with that, then it flips back over to mm-hmm. this other side, because they're doing whatever they can to try to manage it.
And I see that even just with eating disorders. Somebody might come in with struggles with anorexia. So when they first come in, they might show up with completely diagnosable anorexia, but within, you know, we start addressing behaviors, and now all of a sudden we identify as bulimic or binge eating. And people will run the gamut throughout their recovery of just, you know, using, we have to heal our relationship with food, heal our relationship with our body, and heal our relationship with those emotions. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how we get through it. But it is definitely in that same way of, you know, you stop doing one and another is going to pop up. And so just kind of being vigilant about that.
I like the phrase you just used, being able to heal our relationship with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've been told this before, but the way you saying that kind of triggers this part of me that's like, we are sometimes in an abusive relationship with food. And the abusive relationship in this case can be like, you're not eating enough, or you're eating too much, then you're being abusive to your body by like punishing yourself or compensating somehow.
Mm-hmm. There's a shame cycle.
Yeah.
That, and we can, you know, like, just in binge eating, I think a lot of people don't know, well, I ate a lot of pizza last night. Was that a binge? But was it connected to shame? Did you feel out of control as you were eating, or did you have shame afterwards about the amount of food that you ate? Or were you just like, man, I'm full, I need a change into sweatpants. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be a different thing. But yeah, I think it is that relationship with our food, because a lot of us use it for, we connect it to our emotions. Yeah. You know, we hear about people like emotionally eating or bored eating, and we talk about those as being bad, and they aren't necessarily bad, but I think it's worth being mindful of what is going. We talk about mindful eating all the time, intuitive eating. And so just kind of being aware, like, what are my hunger cues saying, and reconnecting to our body and the signals that our body is telling us. Am I hungry? Am I full? Am I thirsty? What am I feeling? Or emotions?
Like you said earlier, talking about some of the brain stuff, reconnecting to our body. Because like you said, the numbness that starts to come up with it, they're starting to ignore a lot of those things. Because whenever they look in the mirror, that's not what they're seeing. So they actually start to pull away from some of those sensations.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of wondering, like, for you working with these different populations, like, give me an idea. Like, you know, if I'm a parent listening to this, I'm wondering if, like, my kid has an eating disorder, what are some things that I might notice in them that would might kind of tip me off that this is going on?
As a parent, you might notice avoiding family meals, eating with other people. I would say something that you see a lot will also be hoarding food. Mm-hmm. So hiding food in the home somewhere. Could be something to be aware of. Frequently going to the bathroom, either during meals or directly after meals, or disappearing after a meal, could be something that is a red flag. And again, kind of going back to that, some of that, like the concentration thing, like not being present, which is we see a lot with just teens in general, and their phones. But if we are struggling to carry on a conversation, and just really that, you know, like maybe it's ADHD, then that could also be combined with the other things, might be something to pay attention to as well.
So I know that eating disorders in particular, they're the most dangerous mental health challenge that any type of clinician faces. They're the mm-hmm. most deadly by far than anything. So I'm just kind of wondering, like, working with or serving these people and their condition, what kind of motivated you to get into this kind of work?
To be really honest, I kind of fell into it. As I said, I was working in a treatment center in California. We had a mental health section and a eating disorder section. And I was working in the mental health piece and ended up like having to sub for a group on the eating disorder wing. And then I started subbing several groups, and then I started taking clients. And there was just something that I was very drawn to. The more work I did in that section of the wing, where I ended up being primarily in the eating disorder wing by the end, because I think a lot of that is some of the pieces, like the perfectionist piece that I was talking about, the shoulding of ourselves, some of the like things that go into that, I identify with very strongly, and I've had to work through my own self. The eating piece may have never come out for me, but I also feel like I was very fortunate, and I was an athlete growing up, and I had very positive, body positive people in my life. And so I think like while I have a lot of the like, the makeup of somebody who might have an eating disorder, I feel like I lucked out. And, but it made working in that wing working with clients who struggle with an eating disorder like feel there was something about it that I just kind of profoundly got what was going on emotionally for somebody.
Mm-hmm. I think that, like you said, like whenever you're drawn to a certain population, that's kind of how we know that we as clinicians do the best type of work with that kind of population that we're drawn to.
Yeah.
And that even whenever we can understand and we can click, I think that I think both components have to be there. Because I know, like, for me personally, I may be able to understand it in a scientific sense.
Mm-hmm.
But if I can't understand it emotionally, there's only so much work. Like, I'm not going to be able to go into that depth work like you're talking about that actually needs to be addressed in order to have some type of healing in that relationship with eating or even in that relationship with, you know, your gender or, you know, anything like that. So I kind of wondered, like, even with working this, like I said, it's a very high risk population. Mm-hmm. Can you give me some idea of some of the training or some of the techniques that you use whenever you are working with these type of populations? Talking about the eating disorder, the trans populations, and even the populations with like the perfectionist type tendencies.
I think one of the most profound training that I research and training that I've done that influences a lot of my work is I have done a lot of training around the idea of incorporating yoga into our lives and how that changes some of the neurobiology and the brain stuff that happens with all of these and that learning to accept our body. In kind of moving forward from that, I do try to use some of it because we talk about it as bottom up therapy instead of top down, and top down tends to be the talk therapy, but bottom mm-hmm. up, we're getting more connected to our body, and when we can do that, it makes the talk therapy a little more effective in my training is the way I feel.
Well, it makes good sense because you're talking about someone that's really detached from their body. So
right.
you can talk to them, but if they're in their head in that logical cognitive place, they're not going to be able to meet you in that emotional place.
Exactly. And so one of the coolest things about my office is that I am next door to a yoga studio. And so I do have access to that if classes aren't going on. And so I keep yoga mats in my office, both for me and for clients. And so sometimes that might just be like laying on the floor with our legs up the wall to just kind of re-regulate ourselves. Sometimes it's breathing techniques, and sometimes it's like full-on movement and kind of getting back into our bodies. And so it was, you know, it goes with everybody's level of comfort. Some people aren't comfortable moving, and that's fine. And so it might just be a breathing to get regulated, but it's all yoga. And so I think that's really important. I have a lot of training. I'm DBT informed. So that's dialectical behavioral therapy. And as well as IFS, internal family systems. And so
can you tell me a little bit about DBT, if I'm just someone that's hearing about this for the first time, what would I need to know about it?
So DBT is something that is going to pay more attention to some of the behaviors that we talked about, mm-hmm. But also with a mindfulness piece. So it's also kind of getting back into like being present. But so we notice the behaviors. If we don't notice, if we're not present enough to even notice that the behaviors are happening, how do we address them? And I mentioned radical acceptance earlier, mm-hmm. and that's a DBT term. And so there's a lot of skills that go in. It's a very skills-based. And so, you know, some interpersonal relationship skills, learning how to relate to people, setting boundaries, asking to get your needs met, I think are all struggles that most people have, to be really honest, but I see are really prevalent in my populations that I see clinically. And so I think, like, there's a lot of benefit to some of the DBT skills that we work through. And then the other one I said was IFS, mm-hmm. which is internal family systems. And that's the idea that we're kind of made up of a bunch of different parts and protectors. And so like that perfectionist piece is there for a reason and protecting you from something. And the idea is to like make friends with these pieces within ourselves and to kind of like come to peace with them, if you will, to mm-hmm. get to a place of like just kind of being present with your kind of finding your like who you actually are, who your true self is, without that perfectionist or self-judgment or whatever the pieces are, that the avoidance that are there.
Okay. I also want to make a comment too. The DBT was actually formed from cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yep.
And the reason I want to mention that is because cognitive behavioral therapy is considered to be one of the gold standards of therapy.
Yep.
Thus, DBT also is too. So it's really good that you know and you're able to implement that. I think that there's actually a good amount of DBT practitioners around the area.
Mm-hmm.
And ironically, though, I don't know if there's a lot of them that work with eating disorders.
Really?
Either way, though. So...
do you mind if I interject?
Yeah, go ahead.
There's a newer piece of DBT that is kind of starting to take hold. I've done a little bit of training on, not necessarily, that's the goal for the end of this year. By the end of 2019, I'd like to get RODBT certified, which is radically open DBT. And it's a slightly different, but is for the person who is a little, so DBT is great for somebody who has large emotions and is needing to learn how to regulate them. RODBT is great for somebody who is so controlled that they never show their emotions. So that person that you were talking about, yeah, that is all up in their head, but they can't feel their body. RODBT is actually a really great resource for them, being able to start getting out of that like control and letting us feel our emotions. And so I have a little bit of training in that, just and enough to like kind of sprinkle in some skills, but that's the goal by the end of 2019 is to get like that certification.
Okay, that sounds great. I haven't heard that program, so thank you for introducing it
to me. I actually wanted to share with you also, I had mentioned yoga as something that I like to add into the therapeutic process, and that I have a yoga studio across the hall. I think one of my goals also in the next couple months is to get a yoga and either body image or yoga and eating disorder group going. So an hour of yoga, an hour of like processing that afterwards. I did groups like that in California. I have not had a chance to to really jump into that here. And so I'm really looking forward to getting that going and started, because it's something I felt so passionate about when I was doing it before, and I saw so much growth from people. So yeah,
I think you can't beat a yoga studio being right across the hall from you too.
Right.
That's just really convenient. I'm kind of wondering, so us just even talking about, so there's a yoga studio right across the hall. You're actually on the second story. You're right off Manchester Road. So I was hoping that you'd be able to do two things for me. So like if someone's listening to this and they're like, wow, like Erin sounds great. I want to be able to get in contact with her, which like we'll have your contact information on there, so they can get to your website and they can let you know that they could schedule something with you. But also if they're looking for you, like, hey, where are you at? Can you just kind of give them some type of landmarks, and can you talk about this yoga studio next door so that they may be able to find you pretty easy?
Yeah. So the yoga studio next door is Shanti Yoga in Maplewood. And I'm directly above Boogaloo, which is about a block and a half away from Schlafly's, and directly across Manchester from Schnucks. So those are probably the best landmarks. Directly below me is Boogaloo, which is like a restaurant, a Cajun Caribbean restaurant. And they have a green awning that goes all the way across. And there's a door on either side of my door that both go to Boogaloo. And then the green awning has a brown has the Shanti Yoga logo on it. That awning comes up to my door, and so you just go up the stairs and the first door on the right is me.
Well, I want to mention too that so there is parking right there on the street of Manchester. There's also public parking right behind these buildings too, and you can take an alleyway out to the front. So Erin, it has been wonderful talking to you, and you actually told me a lot of things that I didn't know, so I thank you for that. And I hope that if anyone's listening to this and they can get an idea of like if you'd be a good fit for them, and they can give you a call. And I look forward to any conversations we may have in the future too.
Thank you so much for coming today. I've really had a lot of fun.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of St. Louis Therapist Spotlight. The music that you're listening to is called Lobby Time by Kevin McLeod, and that is licensed under Creative Commons. And you can find more great tunes like this at creativecommons.org.